and a very warm welcome back to the North of Scotland Parkinson's Research Interest Group with me, Julie Jones, and Helga McFarlane. Well, today we are in for a real treat. We have Rochelle Flanagan joining us again for another podcast. Rochelle is the first person we've been invited back for another podcast. And I suppose that just reflects the breadth of her knowledge. So the last time, for those who haven't listened, Rochelle talked us through some of the impact of women's health and issues around menstruation associated with Parkinson's. But today, her other passion, we're going to hear all about diet in relation to Parkinson's. So Rochelle is really uniquely placed to deliver this as somebody who is living with Parkinson's, but is also a qualified dietitian working in Ireland. And she was the president and CEO of the Irish Nutrition and Dietetic Institute, which is a professional body for dietitians in Ireland. So I'm going to hand over to Helga, who is going to take it away with the first question.
Hi, Rochelle. Hi, Julie. When I was first diagnosed, that was one of the first things that came to my mind, you know, is there any prescribed diet? And I was told, no, that's fine, just eat healthily. But, you know, 9 years down the line, I've come to realise that there's perhaps a little bit more to it than that. So where do we start, Rochelle? Where do you believe a dietitian's role comes in your Parkinson's journey?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks very much. I'm honoured to be there. the person to come back for two podcasts. You know, a dietitian really, I think, should be involved from the very beginning of your diagnosis. So whether you're a late onset, early onset, or young onset, I really firmly believe that diet and nutrition play a very strong role alongside exercise in terms of trying to improve people's quality of life living with Parkinson's and potentially help definitely to improve the symptoms and potentially to slow progression and certainly slow the acceleration of the medication dosages, I think. So, I mean, this is my own, you know, diagnosis. I went to the World Parkinson's Congress in Kyoto in 2019 looking for answers, and I was quite shocked that there was very little research on the impact of nutrition and diet in Parkinson's. And it's sort of been a passion of mine since then to really try and raise awareness around that. And what I would say is, you know, in terms of young onset, there is a role in terms of, you know, interaction with medication. There's a role in terms of exercise. There's a role in terms of symptom management. And actually that kind of is across all ages and stages. But obviously when you get to later onset and more advanced Parkinson's, so there are two different things. Later onset doesn't necessarily mean you're advanced. But I suppose when you have more advanced Parkinson's, then, you know, things like enteral nutrition, palliative nutrition care, you know, they're sort of different. But I think that's what frustrates me is people think the nutrition is only at that end of the scale, rather than actually seeing it as something that can actually improve people's lives, them healthier for longer.
So on a practical level, at my first appointment with you, what questions would you be asking me, and what kind of advice and answers would you be giving me?
Yeah, so, you know, when a dietitian, you know, sees someone with Parkinson's, we kind of look at the whole person, but we would be asking, you know, what your comorbidities you might have. So in other words, do you have diabetes? Do you have pre-diabetes? Do you have celiac disease? Do you have inflammatory bowel disease? So we'd look at that side as well. We'd look at what medications you're on for those conditions, as well as your Parkinson's, what meds you're on for Parkinson's, when you take them in relation to your meals. Do you have any problems with your swallowing? You drool, you know, so we look for all these kind of markers in terms of issues of where Parkinson's is affecting your diet. So in other words, if someone sort of mentions that they are drooling a lot, I'd be sort of saying, okay, have you any problems with your swallow by any chance? Because when you drool, it's an indication that you're not actually swallowing the saliva. And that might be because your swallow is not as strong. And that's something, again, as a dietitian, we would refer on to other therapies. So that would be a sort of flag if anyone mentions anything like, you know, coughing on food or drink or drooling a lot, to see a speech and language therapist. And that's something, again, that's often thought as being late stage or late onset or more advanced. But many people with Parkinson's, even with early onset, can have swallow issues. I myself, I had a problem with a thing called a globus, which is where I felt like I kept on having to clear my throat. And like I spent probably over $1,000, you know, going to Billy's Jack, you know, getting sort of just, you know, a reflux test done and various different things put on PPIs, even though I didn't have reflux. I even went to a throat specialist in case I had cancer, you know, and I kept on saying, I have Parkinson's, you know, and they're no, couldn't be. And then I had a vitrophloscopy, which I learned was something that everyone should have at a baseline when they're diagnosed with Parkinson's. And I was kind of batted off initially about getting that test. But when I did eventually get it, in the assessment, they initially said that there was nothing wrong. But then when I went to see the speech and language therapist, she was like, well, actually, you have the swallow of a 60-year-old. And, you know, I was only in my late 40s at that stage. And subsequently, I asked for the report and it showed me that I did have a dysphagia problem. So, you know, you wouldn't know it. I can, you know, my voice is okay. And so it's about getting in and so you can get, you know, intervention. But this is where a dietitian can pick up on these things. Obviously, we'd be looking at your exercise levels. So if you're exercising a lot in terms of your weight, we'd be looking at whether you've lost weight unintentionally, whether you've gained weight, say post-TBS, which is quite common. And we'd be looking for cravings, you know, people sort of overeating on sugary foods, binge eating, which is higher in people with Parkinson's. You know, the list is very long.
That's really interesting. So you mentioned a few things there that I wonder if we could just go back and unpack. So you covered the swallowing one really, really well. And I think that just makes the need for a sort of multidisciplinary referral on for Parkinson's, doesn't it? And that need to see a speech and language therapist often coexisting with the need to see people like yourself. I suppose something you asked around a bit was about their normal sort of gut health. You mentioned about whether they have celiacs. You know, we were all very aware increasingly this whole idea about the relationship of the gut and how that, whether we got gut first Parkinson's or brain first Parkinson's. What's from a dietetics point of view, your perspective of that and what would you be looking at?
Yeah, I mean, look, again, the gut brain axis is fascinating in Parkinson's. I think there's a lot of answers in it. There is, you know, a lot of talk about a thing called a leaky gut. And if I put in the context of, say, celiac disease, so people with celiac disease have a problem with gluten. And gluten basically is to do with a protein in gluten that people with celiac disease can't tolerate. And it damages the lining of your gut. And that gluten gets out into the body and causes various symptoms, including bowel symptoms, but also pins and needles in your hands or infertility or brain fog. That's caused by gluten. In terms of Parkinson's, we know that it's to do with a protein, a misfolded protein called alpha-synuclein. Now, that alpha-synuclein actually is a positive protein in the gut and apparently does, you know, positive things in terms of helping one's health. But in Parkinson's, it gets misfolded. And what happens is that misfolded synuclein, they feel, goes through a leaky gut and spreads up to the brain. So that's the gut to brain sort of trajectory. And I suppose they're looking at, well, what is causing that leaky gut? So there was a recent paper that came out in terms of celiac, indicating that those who were diagnosed with celiac under the age of 60 had a higher risk of developing Parkinson's disease. Now, that's only one. There's only a few papers, but I think it needs to be looked into more. In terms of inflammatory bowel disease, which is ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, basically they are associated with Parkinson's. But when people are put on anti-inflammatory medication for those inflammatory bowel diseases, that risk disappears. Well, so again, it's an inflammatory process, the inflammatory bowel disease. Celiac is an inflammatory process. And the other thing is that diabetes is an inflammatory, an autoimmune condition. And people with type 2 diabetes have a higher risk of developing Parkinson's. So there's definitely a link between this autoimmune and leaky gut and Parkinson's. So I suppose, you know, from a diet point of view, it's actually looking at, well, how do we kind of bring that inflammation down in the gut? So that's one thing. And obviously then as well, we've got a theory around the microbiome, which is kind of all sorts of microorganisms and bacteria and fungi and all sorts of things that are in the bowel that actually may actually help to trigger that misfolding of alpha-synuclein protein, can worsen the leaky gut. You know, there's a whole kind of gamut of research around that at the moment.
It's such a minefield, isn't it? And so really, you know, there could be some changes that happen because of Parkinson's in the gut that lead to the spread of Parkinson's. But then there's also just, for me, there's the general health and well-being. So when you have problems with a leaky gut, that also means any food that you eat, that would impair the absorption of that food as well. And so when we start, so things that in my area of practice, looking at interest is things around bone health, and we're looking at perhaps the increased risk of osteoporosis amongst people with Parkinson's. So although people might be having a good diet in terms of high levels of calcium, good levels of protein, due to what's happening in the gut, their ability to absorb that and use it effectively despite having a good gut could also be impacted in some way.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's another, you know, question back to Helga's question. What would I ask, you know, someone, and I would ask them in terms of have they had a DEXA scan, because there is a much higher risk of osteoporosis, osteopenia in people with Parkinson's. And they originally kind of thought it was because, you know, older people with Parkinson's stayed indoors more. I mean, like that was the kind of theory behind it. But we know that people with Parkinson's have lower levels of vitamin D in their blood when you test them prior to diagnosis. They also tend to eat less foods with vitamin D, and there's not that very many that contain vitamin D. So there are issues. There's definitely some kind of link around vitamin D and Parkinson's in terms of some kind of metabolic, you know, pathway that is behind it. But also in the practical side is that, you know, falling and breaking your hip is not a good thing for people with Parkinson's. So you want to make sure that you're optimizing your bone health. But the first thing is that they have to have a DEXA, you know, people who don't get DEXAs, because again, there's a lack of understanding in terms of the clinicians, GPs, neurologists, about getting in on that and trying to avoid it getting worse, you know, because you can stop osteopenia and you can stop it from going into osteoporosis.
You're mentioning vitamin D there. Which may have people listening scuttling away and buying their vitamin D supplements or whatever. That then brings us on to, there's so much on social media and on TV and stuff about supplements for this, supplements for that. You also have to be very careful, don't you? What's your view on everyday supplements that you can buy over the counter?
Yeah, I suppose in terms of supplements, that's another area that we would, you know, be asked a lot in terms of seeing patients. And you're right, there's a lot of, you know, stuff on the internet saying, you know, take this B vitamin, take that, you know, whatever supplement. And a lot of them don't have the evidence behind them. It's quite an unregulated industry, the supplement industry. But, you know, naturally, when we live with a, you know, life-limiting progressive disorder as it's marketed to us, you know, we're gonna try and look for things, like gonna be desperate to try anything that's gonna stop it. I don't blame people from doing that. As dietitians, we have to be evidence-based. So things like looking at your vitamin D, you know, are really important. Things like looking at your vitamin B12, your iron levels, your ferritin stores, your folate. They are the kind of key ones that, you know, that I've been looking for. Your zinc levels, potentially, though they can be more expensive to get tested in the hospitals and that. But in terms of the things that are going to have a direct impact to your quality of life, it is going to be the likes of vitamin B12, which actually the symptoms mimic Parkinson's symptoms. So it can be muscle weakness, mood, you know, low mood, depression, pins and needles. And we know that people with Parkinson's, again, prior to diagnosis, can be low in vitamin B12. And also when you take levodopa for a long time, it can impede the absorption of vitamin B12. And also when you get older, there's a tendency for a certain percentage of older people not to be able to absorb vitamin B12 as well. So there's kind of like a number of things that come together. So, you know, it's about choosing the ones that are evidence-based. When people often ask, you know, about other B vitamins, you know, vitamin B1, but again, there isn't enough, you know, really research to kind of indicate that, you know, it's something that people should be taking in high doses. The only thing I would say about it is that high doses don't cause any major harm. You know, vitamin B12 has been shown not to cause any harm, even at high doses, but actually has a big impact on people with Parkinson's in terms of symptoms. You've got vitamin B6. Which in high doses can cause severe nerve damage, leading people to lose control of their bodily movements. You've got folate, which is very important, but it can hide, if you're taking excess folate, it can hide a vitamin B12 deficiency. And in terms of vitamin B3, high doses can make the skin on your face, arms and chest turn red, tingle and itch, and also lead to headaches, rashes and dizziness. So you'll often find in the shops, it will be high dose this, high dose that. You have to be careful. Like, you know, nutrition and vitamins can actually be very powerful in the wrong context. And then there's other things like, so that's kind of vitamins. And then you go on to sort of isolate supplements, which are slightly different in terms of, say, coenzyme Q10. A lot of people sort of, you know, ask about that. Although it hasn't shown sort of major sort of negative side effects, there are certain things like it can interact with warfarin. And the research, you know, is not strong enough to say to people to take enzyme. We have to give our advice on the basis of the evidence that's out there.
At the mention of gut microbiome, I think everybody's mind turns then to pre and probiotics. What are your thoughts on that?
It's a really interesting growing area. We do know that some probiotics can actually improve constipation in Parkinson's. And that is a good thing, because when you're constipated, it has, you know, a couple of effects. One is it can, you know, make you feel awful, you know, in terms of nausea. You know, can put you off your appetite, then you don't eat as much, you lose weight, you know, so it has that knock-on effect. Be very painful. I heard the Movers and Shakers podcast at the weekend and talking about embarrassing symptoms. And, you know, one of the guys sort of said that, you know, he's literally shouting with the pain and grunting to try and pass a bowel motion, you know. And people end up staying at home because, you know, of the bowel symptoms, it stops them from going out, you know. So it kind of has a number of impacts. The other thing the constipation can do is stop your medication from absorbing as well. And back to your question about the microbiome, it basically can lead to sort of a buildup of less healthy bacteria in the gut. And this less healthy bacteria can eat your levodopa. So basically you have less of it to absorb. It can delay, you know, you switching on. So obviously taking a probiotic that helps you to move your bowels and not be constipated, it can be helpful. But there's only really evidence at the moment behind a product that's on the market called Simprove. But it is expensive, like it's 100 odd euros or sterling a month. It doesn't work for everybody. So, but I think in terms of probiotics, there is some research showing that it might actually modulate the microbiome in terms of having, you know, better, healthier bacteria. We need more research on that. What I would say to people is they go out to the, again, health food store and they just pick a probiotic off the shelf. I wouldn't be doing that. Or if you're considering something, I'd be talking to your neurologist about what you're considering doing. I try and stick to the ones that have evidence so far. And also in terms of people with Parkinson's, they tend to, the research would show, be higher in two bacteria called lactobacillus and bifidobacteria. And they are generally seen as being anti-inflammatory bacteria. That's why it's in a lot of probiotics that are on the shelves. But we don't know why they're much higher in people with Parkinson's. So one, is it because they've gone rogue, gone to the dark side, and they're actually pro-inflammatory now? Or is it that, you know, the body is trying to kind of make more of them to sort of dampen down the inflammation? Or the other thing is that we know that some of the bacteria feed on levodopa. So is it that, you know, the more levodopa people are on over time, the higher this levodopa bacteria, if the bacteria in lactobacillus increases? So we don't know. There's so many unknowns. So what I would say then in terms of prebiotics, they are the kind of foods that basically nourish the probiotics in the bowel. So they kind of feed the healthy bacteria. And that tends to be healthy kind of foods. So whole grains, onions, garlic, you know, vegetables, pulses. And so that is why potentially the likes of, you know, people ask what diet is good for Parkinson's. The Mediterranean style diet is potentially showing the benefit in terms of maybe slowing progression, but certainly helping symptom management.
So potentially some of those natural products in the Mediterranean diet themselves may have a sort of probiotic effect in the fact that they're positive for gut health, yeah, rather than buying some of these off the shelf where we don't know what the impact is. And it's really fascinating. The more of these pods that Helga and I do, it just shows how much of our knowledge of Parkinson's has grown. And, you know, since I was an undergraduate physio, where it was just a movement disorder that just affected your basal ganglia, you know, that was it. And, you know, it's huge now, this condition, and research, it's opening up so many different questions, isn't it? And it's and there's no one answer, and also people's gut flora and fauna will also be slightly different. What's right for somebody will maybe not be right for somebody else. And as you say, as we get older, there's changes in our gut, and some people may be more susceptible to sort of IBS or any of these other gut problems, which changes their scenario again. So it really comes back to that, it's that individual tailored approach, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I suppose it is, absolutely, because, you know, in terms of, for example, Mediterranean diet, it would be, you know, advisable, we're saying, to eat a high fiber diet, more whole grains, you know, to help move constipation. But if you're someone who suffers from slow gastric emptying, slow stomach emptying, that could be the worst thing for you to do, because eating lots of fiber slows your gastric emptying. And when you have slow gastric emptying, it's not fun. You know, you feel very nauseous. You feel full very quickly after your meals. You lose weight. Your appetite goes. And then you shove lots of fiber in on top of that. You know, so, you know, and so we have to be very nuanced in terms of understanding what the symptoms are people are suffering from. So in terms of, are they IBS? But again, is it gastroparesis that actually is the problem? It's not IBS. So that is, you know, and then asking in terms of, what medication they're on. So are they on PPIs? Because, you know, PPI can actually make your gastric emptying worse for some people. It can, you know, also increase more of the unhealthy bacteria. It can also, PPIs can interfere with the absorption of vitamin B12. So yeah, one needs to look at the individual and look at the constituent parts.
It's such a minefield, and for those who haven't listened to it, we will put it in our link. That you did that fantastic presentation recently with Thilo Kunath for the Cure Parkinson's Trust webinar that they do, and I think that really highlighted there that, well, for many conditions, we're always talking about a high fiber diet, but a high fiber diet is always beneficial. And while it does have many merits, at the same time, as you're saying, anything that perhaps slows down gut motility could be problematic for some people, couldn't it? So it's again, it's that need for that bespoke, individualized guidance that people require.
Yeah. And it's you know, it's finding out if that is the case. You know, what is it? Is it gastroparesis? Is it irritable bowel? Because irritable bowel syndrome is high in people with Parkinson's. Is it Helicobacter pylori? Is it SIBO, small intestinal bowel overgrowth? And that can eat your levodopa as well. Helicobacter pylori has been associated with onset of Parkinson's. Yeah, I mean, they call it the second brain for a reason, you know, because there's so it's the most innervated place after the brain.
That's a tremendous saying, the second brain. It really does sum it up, doesn't it? Fabulous. I think we really have to look, though, one of the biggest things that I think most people with Parkinson's probably come across once they've got a little bit down the road is this issue of protein blocking, which can become a huge issue for some. Some people are not so bothered by it, yeah, but certainly I think most people at some point will come across this.
It's you know, it was something that when I do a callback service for the Parkinson's Association in Ireland, and I was really gobsmacked when I started doing it, how many people didn't know about the timing of their meds to their meals. And it's to do with the protein, so meats, chicken and dairy. For example, proteins break down into amino acids, and those amino acids in particular cross at the blood-brain barrier at the same place that levodopa does. So they compete against each other. There were many people that literally, that one thing I just said to them, like, let's just time your meds 30 minutes before or an hour or two after your meals, and came back and said, oh my gosh, it was revelatory in terms of improving their symptoms. And it was amazing, like, pharmacists weren't saying it. You know, you'd imagine it'd be the first thing you'd say. Neurologists aren't saying it. You know, health professionals aren't saying it. It's just one basic thing that could make a big difference. But I suppose the only thing I would say again as a caveat is that for some people, separating their meds you know, from their meals might actually make dyskinesia worse. And that is because, obviously, certainly in younger people with Parkinson's, there seems to be a lot more dyskinesia arising from the dosage of their levodopa. So as you can imagine, if you separate your meals from your meds, you're obviously going to absorb more levodopa. So if your tendency is more dyskinesia, that can worsen it. So for some people, it might be that actually, you know, having closer meals are better, or maybe they need to have it separate, but they can reduce the dosage, you know. So it is a little bit of playing around with that for you on a personal level. And I'd liken it to diabetes. You know, when we would work with people with diabetes around their food and their insulin and their blood sugar levels, you would do, you know, they would be sort of testing out, well, what works, what food works and what insulin dose works and in relation to your exercise. And I think that's where we need to go with Parkinson's, is a more nuanced kind of approach, a bit like diabetes.
And it's so many things to think about, because there's, you're thinking about when you're taking your protein and thinking about coinciding with that for medication. But equally, a number of people stop having protein because sometimes they find it difficult to perhaps just the practicalities of cutting out their food. They find the difficulties with chewing the food, digesting the food. And then there's generations which, as they get older, reduce their meat intake, or could even be financial situations. But protein is such an important part of diet when we're thinking about maintaining muscle strength and muscle mass. In particular, I'm just thinking some of the things we touched on the last time when we spoke to you, thinking about the impact of menopause and the potential developing of things around sarcopenia later on. So, you know, protein is a really, really important part of diet, that particularly amongst women, we mustn't, because we're often very prone to reducing our protein intake. But it's not, the message isn't to reduce your protein intake, it's to think about when you take your protein intake is really important. So it's another complex area, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I suppose, you know, you touched on a very important point, is that a lot of people, you know, get fixated on it and then start cutting out their protein, or, you know, it just, they're having, you know, their levodopa 6 times a day. And like trying to time your meds around that and your meals, it's a nightmare. So I don't blame people cutting out the protein because it's just easier. But there is actually a thing called the protein redistribution diet, which specifically can help people with that. So it's where you would take, you know, 90% of your protein in the evening time and 10% of your protein across the other meals. So that means that obviously at nighttime, you're going to have more off because you're taking a whack of your protein in the evening. But if you're, most people working during the daytime, it means that you're more on. I don't want to make it complicated, but I think it's just, that's where getting to see a dietitian to sort of look at the picture and say, okay, what's going on here? What is the lesser of two evils?
It really is. When you describe it like that, all the things that you have to take into consideration, all the things that can affect what you eat, affect the way your medication can absorb, it really is too much for a person to manage themselves, particularly as time goes on. And I can see what the absolutely vital role that a dietitian would take in that person with Parkinson's living their best life.
It is a real need out there. I mean, we did a focus group with people with Parkinson's in the UK and Ireland, and they are actually gobsmacked at how bad things were and how people were being left to cope on their own. They just couldn't get over it, you know, the gap in terms of care. So, and in terms of the problems that came across with people with Parkinson's, it wasn't just, you know, around the time of your meds. One of the big things was cognitive, you know, so in terms of executive functioning. So having the energy and the executive functioning to plan one's meals, you know. So if you think about it, Julian, you go home and you're looking, you're tired and you look in the fridge and you're looking at the press and going, what are we going to make? Put Parkinson's into that picture, you know, and a lot of people talk about their meds not really working as well towards the end of the day, and then they're tired, and then they have kids, and blah, blah, blah. And you have to try and put a meal together. So they end up getting a takeaway instead.
I couldn't agree more. And I think part of the reason why we wanted to have you back, you know, not only is this something that Parkinson's community want to hear about. I mean, as I mentioned before we started this podcast, I think being diagnosed with Parkinson's takes so many decisions away, and taking medication is a very passive process. But actually participating and working with a dietitian, talking about your diet, is something that people can have control over. It's very similar to seeing a physiotherapist and giving you guidance on exercise prescription and how to be more physically active. And I think it really does highlight to me the importance of seeing a dietitian early on, so that we are at that stage, perhaps before things become more challenging, as you've alluded to, is that people can develop a more sort of Parkinson-specific diet that maximises or optimises medication efficiency, that, you know, puts their health and well-being in an optimal situation to prepare them as we get older. And I think that is so, it is so important about making those choices and making those switches, while at the same time recognising that everybody's going to fall off the wagon from time to time and need a little bit of help and support to make those right choices again. But it's about giving those people that knowledge and understanding. There's so many factors which we need to consider for Parkinson's, and I think you beautifully highlighted it today. I'm almost a converted dietitian. This is so interesting. I've got loads of questions.
Yeah, I suppose like there's a couple of things that I just want to say in relation to that. You know, there's a lot that can be done now to help people with Parkinson's through diet. So for example, there was a study done, a 6-week nutrition intervention. So basically the average age was 60 to 68 year olds. 68% of them had abnormal nutritional status. 25% of them were malnourished and 42 were at risk of malnutrition. And their poor nutritional status affected their depression and anxiety level. So they had this 6-week intervention where they had oral nutritional supplements. But basically, in terms of the impact of that intervention, is they had a significant improvement achieved in disease severity, quality of life, and nutritional status. They had a significant improvement in self-perception of nutritional health status, and was also associated with a decrease in depression and anxiety. That was just in a 6-week intervention. So, you know, my call is that needs to be happening everywhere, because people are being left getting worse. You know, and I know there's sort of some people saying we need more evidence, we need more, but actually we don't, for what we know at the moment, just diet and nutrition helps people in many conditions. But then on the other side, in terms of the more like the microbiome, in terms of the inflammatory, in terms of looking at, you know, interaction of genes and diet and Parkinson's, yes, that's where we need some serious research behind. And that's where I think they need to be bringing dietitians and nutritionists who are experts in nutrition research into those studies, because they bring that nutrition perspective. So, for example, my professor, Helene McNulty from the University of Ulster, she is a worldwide expert in B vitamins, vitamin B12, folic acid and homocysteine, which all have some indication that they are involved in Parkinson's prior to people developing it. That's what we need, is those brains in nutrition science to come into Parkinson's to find answers for us. We need to collaborate with gastroenterologists who have expertise in gastroparesis in terms of, you know, people with Parkinson's. So, there's my soapbox.
Oh, I think you can carry on jumping. I think you're probably preaching to the converted, but I think that's a really nice note to finish on. There's some really simple things that we can put in place, as you mentioned about, you know, the 6-week diet program. And then, yes, there perhaps is the science element that requires further investigation. Thank you so much from Helga and myself for joining us again today. And as you say, I feel really motivated in terms of there's lots more things that we can do to see where the future's bright in terms of research in this area.
You've done us proud once again, Rochelle. Thank you very much.